On Monday, North Dakota's governor ordered a mandatory evacuation of the 10,000 people who have been protesting over the Dakota Access Pipeline, which, if built, would end up in southern Illinois. Today, we speak with Danville resident Dean Dempsey, who recently spent several days with protesters in Standing Rock.
I always felt that all the tribes should come together and fight as one, or to resist the government, resist our colonization. Finally step up and say no more.
And we hear more from Minnesota Public Radio correspondent Dwali Sautaukau, who's there now. Also, medical residency can be a brutal process, but the point is for doctors to learn how to care for patients. We'll speak with Evanston Dr. Emmett Hirsch about his debut novel and why being a medical doctor is still worth every minute.
For medical students, I think they're probably scared to death of residency. This book might confirm some of their fears. But if they read all the way through, they'll see there is redemption in the end.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Many people in the state have been following what's happening in North Dakota over the Dakota Access Pipeline, which, if built, would end up in southern Illinois. In fact, the pipeline could stretch across four states, including 12 counties in Illinois. About 10,000 protesters are camped out around the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. They say the 1,200-mile oil pipeline could pollute drinking water and ruin sacred Native American sites. Earlier this month, those protesters included Dean Dempsey. He and a friend left central Illinois and headed west. He spent several days with activists at the Sacred Stone Camp in Cannonball, North Dakota. That's one of a number of camps set up around Standing Rock. Dempsey was born and raised on the Navajo Reservation in Arizona. He now lives in Danville and joins us on the phone. Dean, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
Now, in mid-November, just a couple weeks ago, you were scheduled for a family vacation, but instead you said that you had to go to North Dakota to be a part of what's happening there. What made you want to go?
I always dreamt of a unification of tribes to fight for our civil rights and our way of life. Every tribe has their issues. They have the same issue as the Lakota people are having right now in North Dakota. If it's not oil or coal or gas or uranium, there's always something the government wanted after the fact. They said, this is the crappiest land you can think of that we put you on. So live here. And then the next moment they find out there's some resource they want out of it. So they decide to take it back. I always felt that all the tribes should come together and fight as one, or to resist the government, resist our colonization, finally step up and say no more.
And Dean, you're a member, as you were saying, you're a member of the Navajo Nation. I imagine you, like many of us, have been following the events there through social media, especially through Facebook. Once you were actually there, how did seeing things firsthand, how did that change for you? Did it change things for you?
It changed the way I view my country. I knew that my country, the country Navajos fought for, as far as co-talkers and several of our tribal members are military, and just walking through that blockade where there's military action. I mean, the police were like in military gear and had an MRAD parked out there, and they would stand there with their M16s or the shotguns and the grenades they throw, and, you know, they just look so militarized that it saddened me.
Yeah. Did you see police throwing grenades?
No, I didn't see police, but, you know, just stuff I saw on Facebook. But just I was as part of a small protest, or just how they lined up across the river from us was, to me, unbelievable. I didn't think this would ever happen in our country. I knew it would, you know, some type of resistance would happen toward us, because this is just part of a resistance we've been fighting for 500 years, and that's I believe that's part of the reason every tribe in the United States have band together to fight this, because it's an issue that touches everyone, every Native person.
Mm-hmm. What else did you see there?
People at the camp, the elders were very familiar, as my elders from my tribe. They always promoted prayer and promoted nonviolence. In our culture, you begin your day with a prayer, and you end your day with a prayer. The first thing in the morning, hear over the speaker was, wake up, wake up, pipe carriers, wake up, sun dancers, wake up, Christian, dust off your Bible, polish your crosses. It's a good day to be alive. And they would start their prayers, and they would request people who have morning prayers and morning songs to come and pray and sing. And so when we were there, I also made a huge pot of stew and made some yeast rolls. So when the protectors came back to the camp, you know, just traditionally you feed people, and it was just a time to listen to their stories and listen to their day's event when they went out to an action and their feelings. And some of them were really sad and some of them were uplifting. And people, I think, that are up at the front lines are anticipating and just preparing themselves for that hurt, that violence, because that's all that the North Dakota has shown the protesters or the water protectors, is this violence.
So, Tina, if I can ask you a question, because you said something originally that it, being at these camps, being in North Dakota, made you feel like you looked at this country differently. And I'm sure that it's always been a complicated identity question of being a Native American, being a member of the Navajo Nation in the U.S. But I wonder this experience, I wonder how you view your identity and your relationship to this country now.
I think just because the Navajo code talkers and how my tribe is very, they volunteer for a lot of military. They use Navajo code talkers when it was against, you know, the Western culture for us to use our language. And they were beaten for, we were beaten for using our language. And and the story my grandmother and my elders used to tell us about the long walk, the walk to our concentration camp in New Mexico. And, you know, that always in the back of my mind, and that's still instilled in me. But, you know, this is my country. This is where I live. And, you know, I'm patriotic. There's no other country like this. But all this TV I see where they have third world countries and there's military, there's police attacking these minorities, and all they're trying to do is do the same thing we're doing, is self-preservation. And that's exactly what's happening in North Dakota. Now, seeing those same events happening in my eyes, in front of me, and it was traumatic. I mean, it was something I thought I'd never see, or it's just so heartbreaking and so hurtful to me. But this is still my country, and I'll always honor it.
Will you go back to North Dakota?
Yes, I'll go back as soon as possible and as soon as I can, and because it's a very important fight for me. And, you know, if I could help in any little way, I just really needed to do something. And going to the local newspapers and on the radio show and try to get the word out here in Illinois that if this pipeline, and when it breaks, and it breaks into the Missouri River, it'll flow into the Mississippi River, and, you know, it's going to affect 17 million people. And the 17 million people are going to have no water, and where are they going to get their water? With our culture, we want, everybody's a relative. We come from the same father and we come from the same mother. One father, one mother, and right now, as people, we're destroying our mother. We're hurting her really badly, and we need to stop, and we need to fix her the best we can now and let her heal.
Dean, thank you. Thanks for sharing your story with us. Thanks for sharing your experience. Dean Dempsey is a resident of Danville, telling us about his time at the Sacred Stone Camp in Cannonball, North Dakota, a couple of weeks ago. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Dean's a member of the Navajo Nation. More than 300 tribes are represented, making up a camp of protesters in total about 10,000 people. That audio you're hearing is from the Osheti Shekowin camp near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. We got them from Minnesota Public Radio correspondent Duale Saitaukau. She was broadcasting live last night from Facebook, and she joins us now from there. Duale, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Hello from Camp Osheti Shekowin.
Right. Now, I know we just checked the weather. 27 degrees at Standing Rock, 14 degrees with the wind chill. Duale, I understand you slept in a medical yurt last night?
Yes. In fact, I was actually quite lucky to sleep in a yurt. Most of the places had been quite full with, you know, lots of visitors over the holiday weekend. But then yesterday, because of this winter storm and the dump of snow, people actually couldn't get into the camp either. So the actual yurt that I was sleeping in, I had it all to myself. I was quite fortunate to do that. Otherwise, I would have been sleeping in my car in a couple of sleeping bags.
Now, I mentioned the weather because that's part of the reasoning for the actual evacuation order that was issued by North Dakota's governor on Monday, following what the Army Corps of Engineers said last Friday. Can you remind us what they've been saying to people who were there, to the protesters, about why they want them to leave?
Yeah, the day after Thanksgiving, of all days, the chairman of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe received a letter from the U.S. Army Corps, and it essentially said by December 5th, this camp needs to close. We're closing it for safety reasons, and we're going to offer what they're calling a safe free speech zone south of the river. And basically, it's where, you know, the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation begins south of the Cannonball River where we're at. And but, you know, they're trying to figure out a way to have easier access to emergency vehicles and, you know, for other, you know, police and folks trying to get through here.
Mm-hmm. And now, I know you talked recently with Dave Archambault II. He's the Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Chairman. I wanted to play some of that. You asked him if there had been conflict over the evacuation order.
There's a real threat and a real risk when a statement comes out, when a proclamation comes out, that there's a flashpoint, a heightened concern for safety. That doesn't have to happen. If everyone's worried about safety, the best thing to do is take this blockade down.
What if they start saying, everybody out? What do you do?
I don't think that will happen. I don't think the state of North Dakota and I don't think the Corps of Engineers are going to bring force to remove people. There's 7,000 people down there, and they're hunkered in pretty good. They're staying there. They're not going to leave. And so if force comes, it's not going to be good for anybody. And I don't think the governor wants that on his hands, and I don't think the Corps of Engineers wants that.
That's Dave Archambault II. He's the Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Chairman, speaking to Minnesota Public Radio correspondent Duale Saitaukau, who's with us now. Duale, I mean, it sounds there very clear. He doesn't want a confrontation. It also sounds like the Army Corps of Engineers and the governor have also made it pretty clear about that nobody really wants to be in a situation of forcibly removing people, right?
Correct. I mean, the issue here is probably less about confrontation and more about how do you help anyone who might be in difficult circumstances here at the camp. So Right now, it's estimated to be about 7,000 people on the camp. Already, there have been emergencies. A woman who didn't have her insulin pen and was out here for a little too long was in a pretty difficult situation, and had she not been able to actually get emergency services or an ambulance to come help her, things would have been bad. Or even last night, as security was coming into my medical tent, he was saying that one of the water protectors, their dog, actually like bit him in the eye. There was some small melee between another dog, and so his eye was very infected and essentially was so swollen you couldn't see it. But the ambulance, they can't get out here. It's just
because of the weather, right? Because of the snow,
right? Because of the weather. Mm-hmm. And of course, there have been actual clashes with police at the front line up here. The blockade that Dave Archambault is talking about is that there's a highway here called 1806, and just before the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, police have blockaded that so that the construction can continue, and also so that water protectors don't get into that area. So he's saying that if that highway was actually opened, then emergency vehicles could have easier access and faster access to the people here. So there are a lot of conflicts left and right, but at the end of the day, basically the state emergency services folks, as well as the U.S. Army Corps, have made it very clear that they are not going to forcibly come out here and move people, but they are saying that they're going to find people trying to bring in timber, wood.
Diwali, let me stop you there for a second because we've got to take a break. But when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Diwali Saitaukau from Minnesota Public Radio talking about her time at Standing Rock. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about the Dakota Access Pipeline, which, when fully built, could stretch across four states, including 12 counties in Illinois. Earlier this hour, we were speaking with a Danville resident, a member of the Navajo Nation, who was at Standing Rock at the Sacred Stone Camp. Right now on the line with us from the Osheti Shakowin Camp near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation is Minnesota Public Radio correspondent Diwali Saitaukau. Diwali's been telling us about the conditions there, about the evacuation order that was issued earlier this week. Diwali, you were just saying before the break about people getting hurt. I just want to make clear, those are people like the gentleman. It was just his dogs that were in a fight. There's sort of two levels of injuries maybe we're talking about, right? Just sort of everyday things that are happening with thousands of people who have been camped out there for a while. And then I guess there's the other level of if the people who are the protesters near the front lines, if there are injuries there, are there medical professionals? What medical professionals are on site to address either of those?
So obviously there are nurses and healers here. There's a medical tent with mental health services. A lot of different things are being provided, but in terms of actual MDs, I have yet to meet one. But the issue here is, you're right, there are two different kinds of violence we're talking about, just the normal everyday kind of accidents that happen here. For example, a lot of people have been sleeping in their vehicles, and that's not the safest thing to do if you've got your car, on and you've got, on it for several hours through the night. Those kinds of things people need to be concerned about, how they're sleeping. Also, some people are in winter tents. That may not be the safest in, what feels like 17 degrees out here. So there's a lot of issues in terms of just trying, winterizing and folks staying in a safe place and essentially not freezing to death. And the other issue is clashes with police because, in a couple of weeks past, obviously there was news about how people were actually, the police were using water cannons and certain kind of militarized, non-lethal weapons, according to, the police. So that's an issue.
Well, you've also been covering the many arrests that happened over Thanksgiving, over the holiday weekend. What happened there?
Right. So, obviously with Black Friday, people wanted to raise awareness about what's happening here. So some of the water protectors, as they prefer to be called, went to some of the shopping centers and tried to form a prayer in the middle of all the shopping. And, you know, about 33 folks were actually arrested for a criminal trespass. They were actually seen in court. Their hearing was earlier this week. There are a lot of things going on. And, of course, there's also most recently a class action lawsuit that was filed by some of these water protectors against the local sheriff's department and the police for, again, what I was describing earlier, their claim that the police are using militarized weapons against what they say are unarmed demonstrators out here in the snow, with water bottles, essentially.
Dawala, we just got a tweet from a 21st listener, Paul, who was talking about the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe and the eviction deadline coinciding with the veteran solidarity effort. And I wanted to ask you, earlier we heard from Dean talking about particularly his tribe, the Navajo Nation, how much they've been involved with the American military. I know there's a contingent of Native American military veterans who are scheduled to arrive this weekend. How many are scheduled to arrive now, and what's the plan there?
Well, there has been a GoFund site to try to raise funds for all these veterans. And what we heard at some point was that it was 1,100 vets that were actually going to make their way here. Native Americans who are, you know, their funds, their travel funds are being raised to come here in solidarity. But now we're actually hearing that it's almost 2,000 veterans that have actually signed up and are going to, you know, arrive here between the 4th and the 7th. So this is a pretty big deal. These are veterans who fought for the U.S., and they're coming here to say, you know, enough is enough. This is, according to tribal elders, treaty land, ancestral land, and they want to ensure that, you know, seven generations from now, according to the prophecies, they don't want to, you know, have their water contaminated by a possible oil spill by the makers of this pipeline, Energy Transfers Partners.
So I guess I wonder, my last question for you, Dawala, as we think about that, as everything we've been talking about, the weather, the arrests that have happened, the evacuation order, and now with the veterans scheduled to arrive, what's the mood? I wonder if you can describe for us what people are talking about this morning where you are.
I have to tell you, the spirit here of the camp, and they call it a prayer camp, is incredible. People have come here from across the U.S. They have given up, jobs. They have given up. I mean, there are people who postponed surgeries to be out here. There was a woman who actually gave birth here at camp. There are some incredible stories about essentially folks who are not going to move. They are determined to make this place home, and this is going to be something to see for the next couple of weeks, something to follow closely.
Well, and certainly it sounds like no one's going anywhere in the next couple of weeks. In fact, there'll probably be a couple thousand more people there as of the weekend.
That's right. With the veterans coming, you know, it's going to increase to about 10,000 again. And, as this continues, I suspect that more people will be coming, including, stars and actresses who've already been making quite a bit of public comment about what's happening here. This is despite the crazy winter chills and the snow and the wind blowing like mad, people are staying put. And surprisingly, this is a community here.
Dawala Saitaukau is a correspondent with Minnesota Public Radio who's been reporting from on and near the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in Bismarck and the whole area since Thanksgiving. Dawala, thank you so much for joining us. Stay warm, stay safe.
You're welcome.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. A new novel about medical resident Robert Montefiore is about how he plunges into the sink or swim world of residency in obstetrics and gynecology after his graduation from medical school. And well, we're giving a little bit of this away, but there's a lot of sinking. The debut novel by Evanston Dr. Emmett Hirsch is called The Education of Dr. Montefiore, who in real life is vice chair of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at North Shore University Health System in Evanston. He also teaches at the University of Chicago's Pritzker School of Medicine, and he's on the line with us now. Dr. Hirsch, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So how does someone with all of these day jobs have time to write a novel, Dr. Hirsch?
Not during the day.
Okay.
I did it at night and on weekends, and that's why it took me a long time.
How long did it take you?
Just a couple of decades of night and weekend work.
A couple of decades?
Yeah, I started writing it close to 20 years ago.
Wow. So there's a key, I wanted to ask you about, especially coming off of Thanksgiving last week, we thought it was funny to read that Robert uses a turkey analogy, your main character, to describe how he felt 6 months into his first year of residency. Why did you pick that analogy?
Yeah, that's a scene where during his first year, he just feels so overwhelmed with everything that's being demanded of him, and he feels like he's being stuffed and stuffed and stuffed with more and more responsibilities. And he goes back to his childhood to a scene where he sees his mother stuffing the turkey, and that's how he feels. And it was an analogy that came to me out of the blue, but seemed very apt.
Is that how you felt when you were a medical resident?
Yeah, I think I did feel that way.
Well, and I think for anyone who's been through a medical residency or knows a doctor, we hear how grueling it is. Long hours, not much time to rest, especially when you're at the bottom of the food chain. How does your character, Robert, cope with all of this?
Well, not very well initially, and I think that's a real issue. Things are different nowadays than they were when Robert was in training, which was in the late 80s. So now we treat residents with more compassion, and we treat them more humanely than they were treated in those days. But still, it's extremely demanding. So now the humane treatment is that they only have to work 80 hours a week and not more. And they can only work for 24 hours at a stretch and not more. So you can see that it's still very demanding.
Do you
Robert
think...
didn't cope.
Right. I wonder
he
if
didn't cope very well, but and he, you know, he managed to come through in the end, but it was a touch and go.
And do you think that in real life, the idea of even as you're saying now, things are more humane? Do you think that it's still a residency is still too grueling, or do you think that that's in keeping with the life of some practicing physicians, so it's still adequate training?
I don't think it's too grueling. I'm not among those who think that it's not enough. You know, I think right now we have a pretty good balance in terms of expectations. There is a legitimate question of whether residents are getting adequately trained, but I don't think the solution is to make them work more hours.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you bring up a really interesting notion that you touch on throughout the book, but also you just brought up is the notion of humane teaching practices for residencies. What would you like to see that look like?
Well, I think respect as being first and foremost in terms of relationships among any people, including trainers and trainees. And well, I think we have that. I think we respect them as individuals. I'm talking about residents now, as physicians, as learners, as people who are trying to do their best. I think that's the foundation, and I think that exists. And then we have to have a benevolent attitude towards our trainees, realize that they don't come preloaded with all the knowledge we expect them to leave the program with. So we need to have fail-safes built in so that when there's the occasional mistake or knowledge gap, that the system doesn't result in harm to patients.
Well, in all of this, there are a lot of serious things that you touch on in the book that I'm going to get to in a minute, but how do you, I wonder how you think, you did this in the book, but also I wonder in real life, how do you use humor to kind of lighten this or approach serious issues?
Well, I have a kind of a dry sense of humor. A lot of people that meet me think I don't have a sense of humor at all. And the book, on the other hand, is written as, my intention at least, was that it, in parts it'd be laugh out loud funny, which I think it is. So I have a dry sense of humor that sometimes people don't know if I'm joking or,
right, yeah.
or being serious.
Right.
But the book uses a lot of sarcasm, a lot of exaggeration, and I think you have to laugh, or otherwise it would just be too depressing.
Well, and there's a scene when you say the sarcasm in Robert's second year when one of his friends, Larry, asks him really sarcastically, do you have any redeeming characteristics, any strengths at all? And I wonder how the character of Larry came about, right? Because he's sort of this easygoing, lighthearted guy who also helps lighten up.
Yeah. Well, all the characters in the book are inspired by real people. And I have to say that I am a feature of almost all of the characters. They're all partly me, including the women and the fools and the villains. You know, that's, I found that in my writing, that's how I was able to connect with these characters, is because I knew them, because they were partly me. So Larry is a kind of a composite of different people. I certainly am not that happy-go-lucky.
Okay.
Nothing bothers him kind of a person, but I like that kind of person, and I like Larry.
And do you feel like it's really important for anyone who's in kind of a stressful situation to have a friend like Larry? Is that why you created him?
Yes. Robert has trouble maintaining such friendships, and he really only has Larry. At least initially, and so without Larry, I don't think he would have made it.
You mentioned the idea that this is obviously loosely, or they're composites of different people that you know in real life. I wanted to ask about Robert's nemesis, which is his research advisor. I imagine that's not based on real life at all?
It is. There's a lot of there are people in academic medicine and in positions of medical leadership that really have a lot of negative aspects to them. They're people, just like everybody else. And so this guy has many admirable qualities, actually, but he's not the nicest person. And he's a little insecure, and he takes it out on people, and so that's a real kind of character.
Well, and I imagine when you're training, and obviously not just for medical residents, but any work environment, there's always going to be a character like that. But I wonder what kind of pressure you think it puts on someone when they're in a residency, when a resident has someone who works for them who's that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's you mean that the resident is working under someone.
Correct. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mean-spirited, and it's terrible. And I've seen that during my training, and it was more in my training. I think I haven't seen a lot of it recently, but it's very hard for residents. I've seen residents break under that pressure, and I think if you sign up to be an educator, I think you need to have a benevolent attitude towards the trainees. And you first have to teach, and then you can't take this kind of lording attitude that doesn't respect the person and appreciate the effort that they're putting in, because the trainees, for the most part, you can tell they want to do the right thing. They're trying as hard as they can, and if they're not, then you first have to ask yourself, am I doing a good job training them?
Is that something you think enough people who are teaching residents ask?
From my experience, the people that I'm associated with, yes. If I understood your question correctly,
yes. Okay.
They're focused on doing the right thing and on being good educators.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Dr. Emmett Hirsch, who teaches at the University of Chicago Pritzker School of Medicine. He's also a practicing physician at North Shore in Evanston. His new novel, his debut novel, is called The Education of Dr. Montefiore. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. For tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're speaking with Dr. Emmett Hirsch. He's the author of a new novel, The Education of Dr. Montefiore. We're talking about medical residency, both the fictitious one and his book, and real life. Dr. Hirsch teaches at the Pritzker School of Medicine at the University of Chicago. He also practices. He's the vice chair of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at North Shore University Health System in Evanston. Dr. Hirsch, as we've been talking about your main character in the book, Robert, this is a story about his residency and medical training, but it's also about friendships and relationships. Just before the break, we were talking about Robert's friend, Larry, and there's a romantic piece of this. And I wonder if you could describe the scene that involves Robert when he meets Maggie, who's Larry's cousin. How did that come about? What's their relationship like?
Well, he's this very self-conscious, kind of insecure guy, and doesn't develop relationships easily. And he meets Larry's family at the graduation ceremony, where he's just reflected long and hard about what it means to be a physician and, you know, what he hopes for in his future. And then he falls instantly in love at first sight with a woman who's Larry's cousin. And he suddenly, his reality suddenly hurtles out of focus, and he's completely sent off his moorings. And that was the meeting that he had with his with this girl whose name is Maggie. And I will say that that meeting was inspired by my relationship with my wife. You know, that was a kind of experience I had. Not necessarily at first meeting my wife, but I would say at third meeting with my wife, that I was completely cast off my moorings.
And like Robert, did you pass out on your first date with your wife?
No. There is a little bit of invention in the
story, right?
So I was able to make some things up.
So I think it's so interesting how Robert has many attempts to try to win her love. He fails several times. Why did you think that was important to include in the book? All the things he does wrong. And then eventually gets right.
Well, I think there is an important theme here, which is that Robert can never be a whole person, a complete, happy, satisfied, fulfilled person until he gets all the elements of his life aligned. And I believe that's true for everyone or most people. So people talk, for example, there's a meme in modern medicine about work-life balance. I don't like that term because I think it's life balance. Our work is such an important part of who we are that's regardless of what work you do. You know, any kind, whatever you do, it needs to be in balance with the rest of your life. So his imbalance in his residency parallels his imbalance in his relationship with Maggie. And until he aligns all of it, he's not going to find peace and fulfillment.
Well, and I think that's a tough thing, right? Because as we were just talking about the hours that doctors work, especially during their residency, how do you think it is possible? I understand what you're saying, that it is really important in real life to achieve that work-life balance. How do you think people can do that?
Well, I think it is difficult in residency, and I think a lot of residents have to suspend their fulfillment until they're done with their training.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's less so nowadays than it was in Robert's day, but still, it may not be possible for some people to achieve this balance. And I think that's one of the things, that's possibly the most challenging thing about a residency. And so when it's over, you can get back to the business of getting balance into your life.
Mm. Do you think people understand that going into medical residency?
I think they do. I think they're very fearful of that. And it possibly isn't as bad as they fear.
Mm.
But I think most people are, you know, very concerned about that.
I'm speaking with Dr. Emmett Hirsch. His book is called The Education of Dr. Montefiore. You said you took decades to write this. Again, I assume there was a lot of good work-life balance involved in this, right, because of how long it took. Was there anything in the writing that you ended up getting totally taken out because things changed over time?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a lot of revision that was involved. A lot of things came out. It's good stuff, so I hope to have a chance to use it at some point. It wasn't so much because things have changed. I think it's just a process. I don't know much about what other authors experience, but I imagine that it's similar for other authors. You know, as the story develops, things change, and they, you know, other things go in, other things come out. And one thing that I learned about the process of writing and creating this book was that I didn't approach it the right way. I think that most authors who know what they're doing first have a very clear idea of the entire story and where it's heading. In my case, it developed organically.
Mm-hmm. And what was your process? Was it something that you worked on? Did you work on sort of continuously, sporadically? What was that process like?
It was very sporadic. So, like I say, nights and weekends and vacations. And
sure.
So, you know, when our family would go on vacations, I would wake up at 5 in the morning to write, and then I'd be tired the rest of the day, and my wife would get frustrated with me because, you know, I wasn't alert during family time, and it was pretty difficult. Everybody contributed, not just me sitting down and writing.
Right. I wanted to ask you, there's no surprise, there's several birth scenes in this novel, and I think many times you seem to be reiterating throughout the book that the vast majority of the time nature takes its course and a new life emerges. And if doctors try to take credit, doctors may try to take credit for that, but you point it back to nature. And I wonder, is that something you feel like obstetricians in particular need to be reminded of? But all doctors do, whether it's birth or other things, that even though many times there may be tools to intervene, particularly when we're talking about birth, maybe we should wait and let nature take its course?
I think that's very true. I think doctors, no less than anybody else, if they have a tool, they're inclined to want to use it. And I think first we need to ask the question, are things going to be fine without us intervening? So there are, and I think this is a difficult concept for patients to appreciate in all circumstances, that there are consequences to unnecessary testing, to unnecessary procedures. Sometimes the best approach, often the best approach, is to just let nature take its course, and then intervening under a defined set of circumstances, which is called a medical indication, a medical reason to do something other than let things happen naturally. Now, that's particularly true in the case of childbirth, and possibly less true in the case of chronic disease, for example,
sure,
where things are already out of control, possibly.
Well, it's interesting, though. It reminds me of a conversation we were having about antibiotics a couple of weeks ago on the program about the patient education around people letting doctors sort of say, you know, in some cases I can talk to you and examine you, and when there's something that may be not a serious illness, just to be clear, we're not talking about serious or chronic illness, there may be times when doctors say, you know, you need to just rest, or you need to do, you know, when we're talking about a cold, for example. Do you think that, you think patients probably, there's not enough a culture of patients maybe letting doctors say that? Or accepting that?
Yes, I do. And antibiotics is a really good example because, you know, for the doctor to tell the patient, you know, just stay hydrated and rest and, you know, call me in a couple of days, the patient may come away with that and with an impression that the doctor doesn't care, is not willing to do something for them. Whereas giving antibiotics for a viral illness, for example, and it's, I think most people know that antibiotics don't treat viruses, has all kinds of negative consequences, both for the patient and for society in general. And so the antibiotics is a great example of over-treatment and kind of short-term intervention that may cause harm in the long run.
Well, and certainly there needs to be a lot of education on the patient side in order to change our culture. Do you think there's enough education on the doctor side in this area of doctors, of sort of accepting that doctors are human and can be offering advice and make a decision about whether or not medical intervention is necessary? Do you think that's changing?
I think most doctors are educated towards evidence-based practices and having medical indications for anything that they do, but it's very hard to face a patient who is suffering or uncomfortable in some way and then not take some kind of action that will be interpreted by the patient as my doctor is helping me in some way. So I think that I see in my day job, one of the things that I do is that I read a lot of narrative comments that patients make about the various physicians in our hospital. And I think what I see there sometimes is patient interpreting the doctor as not caring, when in fact the doctor was trying to uphold the principles of good medical practice. It's very difficult.
Well, and it's also really difficult with doctors caring too much, right? And there's a scene where your fictional character, Robert, where he experiences losing his first patient. It's due to a complication following a routine hysterectomy. It must be, I wonder how much too you had sort of Robert's character kind of portray the overwhelming feelings of guilt that doctors sometimes may feel about things that they can't control.
Yeah, it's an important notion. He certainly blames himself for that event, and he's not really persuaded by the people who tell him that it wasn't his fault and it was inevitable. I think doctors certainly have that feeling. It's a concept that is now pretty well known. It's called the second victim. So you have the patient who suffers an adverse event, and then now people are starting to recognize that in some cases there is a second victim. I don't like that term so much because it tends to equate the the suffering of the doctor with that of the patient. I don't think they're comparable, but recognition that the doctor also suffers as a result of something that happens to their patient is important.
And so there's this common thread throughout the book, and it's in letter. It's at the near the beginning of the book. It's a letter that's inscribed on the front cover of a medical dictionary that Robert gets at his graduation ceremony, and it's from an emeritus internist. And the message says, I thought this was an interesting thing. And you brought this up before, but Robert, it says, for each person, there's a key to professional happiness, and yours is to let yourself enjoy the work that you so clearly love. This key to professional happiness, I wonder, do you think this is something that all physicians need to learn in order to reach their full potential?
I don't think all physicians need to learn it, because some have it naturally, and maybe even most have it naturally. But certainly a lot of them aren't even aware that they need to allow themselves to find the love in what they do. But certainly it was true for Robert. Robert is more morose, less in touch with his own feelings than most people. So possibly not, that may not be such a common issue.
Did writing this, was this a way for you to kind of remind yourself of what you love about your work?
Not really, actually. I share many qualities with Robert as I do with other characters in the book.
Which is an adversity to not wanting to discuss your own feelings.
No. Well, that has been a problem for me, actually. I really admire those writers who are so brutally honest that they lay all their darkest thoughts out on the page, and I don't think I've done that here. But I love being an obstetrician-gynecologist, so I love my work. I've never had any doubt about it. And during my residency, as difficult as it was, I loved it because it was just so action-packed and so exciting, and so many things were happening, and my learning curve was so steep. So I think most, I achieved that state in the end, but I think in the beginning I was much more like Robert than I am now.
The novel is called The Education of Dr. Montefiore. The author is Dr. Emmett Hirsch, who's been speaking with us. He is vice chair of the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at North Shore University Health System in Evanston. He's also a clinical professor at the University of Chicago's Pritzker School of Medicine. Dr. Hirsch, thanks for taking the time to be with us. I appreciate it.
Nyla, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
That does it for us today. Tomorrow on the program, speaking of medicine, it's World AIDS Day. We're going to be talking about HIV infection in Illinois. We're going to be talking about progress that's been made, especially here in managing the disease, but worldwide as well. Also, New York Times bestselling author Elizabeth Berg joins us from Chicago. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app if you search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. All of those links, every other way to contact us, if you want to send us an email, leave us a voicemail, follow us on social media. It's all at our website, 21st. Show.org.
We're produced by Hala Delahi, Christine Herman, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Jason Croft with help from Steve Mark. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.